I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Strong talk that goes around on the radio comes around on the web at radioopensource.org. Our guest, Ishmael Beya, author of the war memoir A Long Way Gone, would seem to have been selected to tell the world about children's wars, selected by grace, selected by the United Nations, by his second family in New York, by Oberlin College, by his own charisma and writing talent, to tell the story of boy soldiers from Burma to Sri Lanka to Sudan to his own West African home of Sierra Leone in the 1990s. Human Rights Watch says there are a quarter of a million kids, girls too, fighting in more than a score of conflicts around the world. Ishmael Beya's is the account that has caught on in the U.S. this spring, featured in that fancy coffee chain, to teach us something fundamental about war. Help us learn the lesson with your own comment or question at www.radioopensource.org. Ishmael Beya, welcome to Open Source. We're all reading and comparing notes on your pretty horrifying and yet somehow redemptive book, A Long Way Gone, Memoirs of a Boy Soldier. There are glimpses of heaven as well as hell in your book. And maybe you ought to just start with the family bonds, the kindness of Village Africa before they were all torn apart. You were a Shakespeare scholar and a performer. Give us a taste of the life you were born into in your grandmother's village.
Well, you know, my grandmother lived in a place called Kabati, and I was born somewhere in Matrujong, and I later lived in a village called Matrujong. My life was very simple, but yet remarkable in the sense that, you know, I didn't have tap water, electricity, or any of those things, but I went to school. You know, I learned Shakespeare because of, you know, Sierra Leone being a former British colony. And at the same time, I was introduced to American hip-hop. So after school, I went to play soccer. I went bird hunting with my friends afterwards. You know, I went to fetch water and, you know, I went swimming in the river. My life was just filled with complete happiness. And also there was a strong sense of community where everyone cared deeply about each other. If my family wasn't home, say my father was still at work, a neighbor would dish me a plate of food for the night. And sometimes if I walked to see my grandmother and I couldn't make it to her village at some point during the evening, somebody would host me, feed me, and then aid me along the next day. So I just had a beautiful life. There was also a strong sense of traditional storytelling. I come from a tribe called the Mende. And, there were a lot of stories told early as a child that you listened to and was supposed to remember and retell it at another gathering. This was a way that, you know, the adults and older people particularly imparted knowledge in the young and taught them the moral and ethical standards of this community. And it was just a beautiful life that I had.
Well, you certainly carry on the storytelling talent and tradition. What warning did you have, Ishmael, that war was coming?
There were several. You know, first of all, there was a war that started in the neighboring Liberia in the 80s. And we started seeing refugees from that part of that region. And they came through and spoke about what had happened to them. But we couldn't believe it because the culture that we lived in our traditions. And we just couldn't imagine that people could become that violent to each other at all. And so even during when the war started in 1991 in Sierra Leone, the eastern part of the country around the Sierra Leone-Liberian border, we also started seeing Sierra Leoneans coming through our towns, villages, and speaking about these things that had happened to them, how their families had been killed in front of them, their houses burned, some of their children forced to participate in this madness as well. We just could not completely comprehend what they were saying. I mean, we saw that they had lost something that, you know, made everyone happy in our community, that they weren't smiling genuinely anymore. But we just could not understand that it was possible for the community that we grew up in, for people in that community to resort to what these people were telling us. But we later came to find out that we too had that capacity in us because of the circumstances that brought that out in us.
Ishmael, you don't write a great deal about the politics of this war. If ever there was a plague war that just came like bad weather this sounds like. And I keep wondering, was there any logic at all in this killing? And could it, a separate question, was there anything that could have stopped it or prevented it?
I think so, too. I think there are a lot of things that could have prevented it. First of all, the reason why in my narrative I didn't speak very much about the politics is because as a kid growing up, I was not invested in politics as much. And, you know, I heard about it through adults and things like that. So I felt like by writing about it with my experience, it would have been a way for me to say something that I didn't really understand as much. So I left that out because of that. But after having learned from what happened in Sierra Leone, having thought about it deeply, what happened as a young person that I saw is that there was an endemic political corruption. And because of that, there were no schools, were getting really dilapidated, or there were no hospitals, people were out of work. And so people began to hope for something new to come along. And so when the RUF, Revolutionary United Front, which is the rebel group, started, people thought this was it. This was the revolution force that we needed to get rid of these corrupt politicians that had been in power for so long. But that quickly changed into these rebel groups were actually attacking civilians who they said they wanted to fight for. So at some point along the lines of the war, whatever the reasons were for its occurrence were missing, it became just a war of survival because all for the basic limited necessities that were available, you know. And so it became a war just of that. People had to fend for whatever was available. And there were lots of guns being brought in because of the diamonds. So people used those guns to fend for themselves. And this required all armed parties to terrorize civilians because the civilians are the ones who had those, food and shelter and things of that sort.
You know, Ishmael, on this program, we've talked about the social science of violence and the speed with which ordinary people can be conditioned to incredible cruelty, torture, hatred, destruction. And now you've lived it. How did it happen in your own experience?
Well, you know, after, you know, we've been hearing about this when it finally came to my part of the country, you know, I'd actually gone to a variety show and then I would try to return home to see, to try and see if we can find family that we've been separated from because this war immediately reached our town without really, we didn't think it would happen. And so as on that journey, going back, it was the first time that I was really touched by or that I saw what war really was, what these people who had spoken about it, what it really was. And I saw so many things, just people who had been pierced in different parts of their body with bullets. But one thing that I saw that I really began to know that this world that I knew had ceased to exist or was significantly disintegrating was I saw a woman who had been running from the war. She had a baby on her back that was tied on her back, and the baby had been shot dead behind her back, but she didn't notice that she was running. So when she stopped at where we waited along with other people, she took the baby from her back, her baby, and looked at this baby, and the baby was dead. And she was in so much pain and shock to shed tears that she just held the baby there. She just kind of was heaving, and she could not cry at all because it was too painful for her. Having seen that kind of stuff, you know, at the age of 12, and there was no one to explain to you what was going on, was in itself too much to traumatize you. And seeing this, we began to fear, you know, this landscape that we had once loved being on became very scary. You feared the forest, the path. It just became too difficult to live in this world where things had changed so quickly, so significantly.
There were people who knew precisely how to take advantage of your fear and your anxiety. And this phrase that came back and back in your training, visualize the enemy, the rebels who killed your parents, your family, those who are responsible for everything that has happened to you. How long, it's not the how long question, it's the what did you feel happening in yourself when you began to accept that premise?
Well, I think when I began to accept that premise, it came along with a lot of other things. First, being exposed to a lot of killings, you know, where I was, there were a lot of exhibition killings just to indoctrinate children in this war. Mm. And also, there was a strong sense of coercion, where if you didn't do what you were told, you were killed. But after a while, with the drugs and everything, these words begin to believe them. And you can see yourself, I felt myself the first day of war, descending into some sort of nightmare, some sort of madness. But after a while,
Who controlled the drug supply, Ishmael?
The commanders and the adult soldiers will control the drug supply. In the beginning, they will give this stuff to you. They will give it to you. They will give it to you before you went out to fight and after you returned. And every time you get a chance, there was no time to sit or think about what was going on. But as time went on, you develop an addiction to it yourself.
The drugs were what? The
drugs range from your common marijuana, alcohol, to brown brown, which is a mixture of cocaine and gunpowder. Sometimes it could be heroin and gunpowder. And these things are mixed together. And when you take them, it numbs you from everything. It numbs you from feeling even for yourself. You know. So, for example, if you get pierced by a stray bullet, so you step on a twig that goes into your foot, you would not feel any pain. So as time goes on, you lose the ability to exhibit those human emotions that you had once been able to exhibit so well. So because of this, when this rhetoric of, visualize the rebels that kill your family and did this, these things begin to make sense. You begin to believe them. And these groups also become your surrogate family after you've lost everything that's there for you. So these adults, they knew what they were doing. They knew that if a child is fully functional, they cannot do the things they want them to do. So they try to brainwash you, feed you the drugs, expose you to so much violence, and feed you this rhetoric because they knew you were angry at what you had lost, your immediate family. So they use that and twist it around in a way that they can use you to do their war, basically.
We haven't answered the question of whether it could have been stopped. I mean, we'll come to that after a short break. Our guest is Ishmael Beya. His memoir of war in Sierra Leone has become an astonishing bestseller, featured at Starbucks. The phenomenon of this book and its success is a story in itself. We'll get to that with Ishmael Beya. This is Radio Open Source. Make a comment at www.radioopensource.org. We'll be back.
Hi, this is Dave Miller, Open Source Senior Producer. Greta put up a new Pitch a Show thread on Friday and counted all the suggestions that turned into shows. We did 12 shows based on your recommendations in March and April. Everything from Hannah Arendt on The Banality of Evil to Shakespeare on Power. We did Camille Paglia because of you, and you told us that Sonny Rollins was coming to town. You can read the whole list on our site, but we're more interested in the future. Point us in new directions at radioopensource.org.
Open Source is produced in association with WGBH Radio in Boston. This is Open Source from PRI. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, talking with Ishmael Beya, who wrote A Long Way Gone, Memoirs of a Boy Soldier in the Civil War in Sierra Leone. He was 12, 13 years old in the 1990s. You speak about the insanity of drug addiction, of this kind of crazed excitement, and let it just be said, Ishmael, that there was almost nothing you didn't do and wouldn't do. At one point, you speak of prisoners being lined up six of them with their hands tied, and you write, "I shot them on their feet and watched them suffer for an entire day before finally shooting them in the head so that they would stop crying. Before I shot each man, I looked at him and saw how his eyes gave up hope and steadied before I pulled the trigger. I found their somber eyes irritating."
That is true. During that time, you're lost. I had lost all sorts, any kind of feeling for anyone. You know, there was no sense of remorse. There was nothing at that time because I'd completely lost myself in this madness. Mm. And sometimes I think people think about it and they think perhaps it's impossible for other people to do that. But I think anyone who finds yourself in the circumstances that some of us find ourselves in, especially if you're a young person, you're not emotionally, psychologically mature to do something, to know what's good for you, you can be victimized to behave these kinds of ways.
You say victimized. I mean, do you stress over that line between your own war crimes and your own victimization? Which were you, a perp or a victim? Or do the words even make sense?
Well, I think all children who are in that war are victims, because when you're 12, some kids 8, and you've lost everything that's dear to you, your family, your village, your town, whatever, and then these guys basically put you at gunpoint. If you don't join this, you will die. And if you run to another group, they will kill you as well. So in that sense, I think I consider all children who are part of this, including myself at that time, as victims. Because first of all, you're victimized in order to be able to commit some of the things, the atrocities that they make you commit. So they can't really be held responsible for any of that, I believe.
The game seems to be constructed really to destroy everybody who plays it.
Yes, that is the idea. You know, it's not just the person who's doing the slaughtering with the bayonet. It's those who are there, who are cheering him on. It becomes a world where this is celebrated, where everyone becomes culpable in that way. And because of this, you just develop a strong sense of attachment to the groups, because all of you have participated in this kind of madness, and therefore there was no way you can get out of it, basically. So this is a way to make everyone complicit in a way.
Yes. Sooner or later, I mean, they don't. I'm sure they don't announce this, but everybody's supposed to die. Everybody's supposed to. It's supposed to implode. Your own immediate family, most of the boys that you name in your ranks, got chewed up and killed by that war. You are one in hundreds, maybe thousands, that was rescued and then rehabilitated in a most extraordinary way. We want to know how it happened, starting with, in effect, your arrest and detoxification, a lot of counseling. Chart that road back.
Well, I had been, I'd been running from the war for a year. I'd lost my immediate family. And then, I'd been in the war itself fighting as a child soldier for over 2 years. And then, but the use of children in the war in Sierra Leone had become so rampant, at that time that, the rebels, the government army, the CDF, which is a civilian group that came later on, everyone was using children. So because of how, rampant this has gotten, UN agencies such as UNICEF and other places went in and tried to remove children from this war. And basically they would go into the bushes and they would speak to commanders. And the reason why they were able to do this is because there's certain international legal standards in place that say you cannot recruit children. So they went and did that, and they were able to bring these children out. I happened to be lucky to be one of those people chosen and brought to a rehabilitation center in the outskirts of Freetown, a place called Beninhome. And there I started my rehabilitation. Now, that movement, my selection, my surviving that war, none of this I had any part to play in. Because, it could have been the next guy standing next to me. It could have been, I would have died in that war before they came to take me out. So none of those things I have anything to do with. But after I was brought to the rehabilitation center, the process started, which began with detoxing from the, detoxification from the drugs itself. And then there was the psychosocial therapy, which all the memories, you began to really understand sort of the heaviness of the things that you had been a part of. And that wasn't very pleasant to think about and to live with. And then, but it was just the people who were at the center were very selfless and compassionate. And they were able to show us that, yes, you can trust another human being again, which is what we had lost after that war, the ability to trust in human beings themselves.
Can I just say parenthetically, we knew about that war, and I did radio programs about the Children's War in Sierra Leone. At the time, or in retrospect, do you think anybody on the outside could have done a lot more?
I think definitely people, governments could have done a lot more. You know, individuals, you know, who knew about it, there were very few, very limited number of people. When I moved here in 1998, a lot of people that I spoke to didn't even know Sierra Leone was a country. Mm. They used to say what was unfolding there. So there was still that. But I think people like governments, people, you know, in other higher places in politics knew about it. But there's a kind of way where people don't want to say they know about certain things because that brings about a sense of responsibility, especially when it comes to a level of governance. Then people don't want to agree that it's going on because then they're in a place to do something. I believe that if people put a stop to it earlier, they would have prevented a lot of lives from being cut up in that war or being destroyed. First of all, the indications were there. When it started in Liberia, it was clear that this was going to spill over in Sierra Leone based on what was going on in Sierra Leone. But no one was willing to provide security at that border to make sure that this didn't happen. Because I think, you know, internationally speaking, politics, you know, preventive measures are not something that are popular.
Speaking of responsibility, in the book, you write about the Benin Center and your rehabilitation and a little moment where one of the staff there says to you, "It's not your fault that you did such a thing," referring broadly to the war. "It made us angry," you write, "because we wanted the civilians at that place to respect us as soldiers who were capable of severely harming them. Most of the staff members were like that. They returned smiling after we hurt them. It was as if they had made a pact not to give up on us. Their smiles made us hate them all the more." Whose fault was it that you did such a thing, and why was that such a provocative question?
Well, I think it was in the beginning. Again, you know, after you've been living this life, after I was living this life, including the kids that I was brought to the center with for such a long time, we had been conditioned to believe that all that we were doing was right and that we had been a part of something that was actually, you know, preventing what we were doing from happening to people, you know, in a weird way. So when we were brought to the center, our reluctance to believe in that or to even having people say that was not a way of saying that we associated more with being a perpetrator, but rather it was just, and we needed time to undo some of these things that had been done to us, the brainwash, the psychological manipulation. So when you're in the war, one thing that you thought was that there's a combatant and a civilian, and there's a stark difference in that as a combatant in that world, in that war particularly, you were in a position to determine what happened to civilians, the fate of their life, what happens to them. So all of a sudden you're somewhere where they're telling you what to do. It was very upsetting, for one. And secondly, when somebody says that it's not your fault, as you, when you've come from that, it's almost belittling everything you've come to believe or belittling you as a soldier. So that's why these things were really upsetting. But as time went on, we began to realize what it was saying. As we healed slowly, we began to know what that meant. But in the beginning, there was no way to conceptualize that at all.
There was a conditioning to insanity. There was a reconditioning to humanity, Ishmael. Which is harder? And which takes the more exalted skill?
I think it's conditioning to regain your humanity. That is harder. That takes more skill because, first of all, that is a selfless act. The people who are doing that care deeply for you just for your own good. Whereas the other one, conditioning to become violent, the people who are doing it to you don't care about you because they don't care about your life. They will want you to die for what they believed in, and which they're not willing to die for. So regaining yourself actually requires more time than turning a child into a killer. It's easy. You destroy everything they know, which anyone can do. But making a child into regain their humanity requires you to undo all of that and also insert in them a trust and an understanding of their own self-worthiness as human beings, and to be able to believe in that again. And that is a long-term process that requires a lot of perseverance and patience.
Who are the people that understood that?
The people that understood that were actually Sierra Leoneans, who I consider my true heroes, you know. They were men and women who worked at this rehabilitation center that we were staying at Benin Home, from an organization called Children Associated with War, CAW. And these people were just the most remarkable people I've ever known in my life. But again, this goes to what we've spoken about before, how in this culture there was such a deep respect for life and care that some people still retain it even through that war. It never got completely wiped out, you know. And so people were able to still show that kind of kindness. In Sierra Leone before the war, there's a saying that became popular after the war, you know, just to make people understand the need to help others more, which is that there is no bush to throw away a bad child. And so after the war, this became quite popular just as a way for people to regain that strength that they needed to be able to help those people who were affected by war, especially the children who had been dragged into this so much.
Ishmael, on our website, radioopensource.org, people anticipating this conversation wrote in, Bobo among them, put a provocative question. He said for himself, coming back from a violent place, the peacefulness at home puts him on edge. And he wonders, do you, Ishmael, ever crave violence or feel nostalgic for it? Do you ever think fondly of your experience as a soldier?
No, not at all. I believe strongly. Then again, this varies for everyone. But I believe strongly, after you've lived through such a life, you've survived it, you don't want to have anything to do with violence. I don't want to have anything to do with any form of violence, because I know that it only brings about suffering and nothing more. Fear and distrust for others that makes you not live in peace with yourself even. So because of those things, I don't want to go to that at all. And I don't even fantasize about it. I think people have a romantic notion of it because they don't really know what it is to be in war, to be affected by severe violence, you know.
I wonder how that works out in your entertainment, in your language, in your ambition. I mean, you grew up, you were conditioned by the movies, Commando and Rambo, by violent rap music. You swam in it. How different is your taste or are your choices today, Ishmael?
Well, you know, like I see war movies, you know, like I saw Letters from Iwo Jima, which I think is absolutely good because I see things that try to teach people about what war really does to human beings. I don't see ones that are just senseless sensationalization of violence, because I think for people like me who haven't lived through violence, when other people see that and take it for what it is, then it becomes destructive to them. Same goes for hip-hop music or any kind of music that promotes violence when people listen to it. And most of the people who sing through this music or who present this kind of sensational ideas of war and things are people who have never been touched by it, so they don't have any deep understanding of it. But when people take it for what it is, then it becomes destructive to them. Now, if I see these things, I know that immediately the person who's saying it or doing it, presenting it, doesn't know what they're talking about. So it does not affect me to that level because I've lived through it. But I worry about how people are receiving it. I still listen to things. I still watch things. But I'm very selective with what I do because, you know, I don't want to waste my time on things that are not going to improve my thinking. You know?
Ishmael, where do you feel compelled to tell Americans about the entertainment values of war and the violence in our culture? Not to mention our policies.
Well, I think there's a lack of understanding from the public. I think I really strongly believe that the public sometimes does not really know what violence is and what certain things are, and because they don't have a humanistic connection to it, that people are willing to, you know, to believe certain things more. For example, you know, when I was writing the book, one of the things I thought about, if I had written, you know, just about the politics, which I could have done research and written about, it won't penetrate people very much. But when people go to the humanity of things, then there's that human connection. For example, if it says a civilian casualty during war in Sierra Leone, that does not do anything to anyone's imagination. Somebody can walk away from that and do whatever. But if you explain what that means that a child who is 7, 8 is sitting having dinner with their family and a bullet goes through their father's head, and that child, there's no one to explain what that means, and that child has to live in that world. Or maybe where there are girls who are being also used in this war, and some of them are raped by the commanders, and they are forced to have babies during this war and have to take care of them. When you explain it at that level, then people see the human connection. They cannot turn away. Then it's not just sensationalizing, it's humanizing it to the point that people fail to think of these people as African, Burmese, Sri Lankan, but rather they become just human beings who are living through
a
difficult time.
Amen. It helps in your book that these people have names and they're friends of yours. We were all struck by a passage in which a friend of yours on the run early on, Saidu, says to you, "How many more times do we have to come to terms with death before we find safety?" And he says, "Every time people come at us with the intention of killing us, I close my eyes and wait for death. Even though I am still alive, I feel like each time I accept death, part of me dies." Saidu himself was killed not long after that. But I keep wondering, you talk about... I think it's right to strip the politics out of this story. And I'm also wondering, why isn't there a bestseller on an Iraqi child who's been brutalized by this war that the United States is so deeply involved in? Could we bear to read the story if we had to attach our own politics to it? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think definitely you could. Again, it depends on how the person writes it, you know. Depends on what the person decides to do. The person writes it from just a way of connecting the human beings, making them see what goes on. Then people would make that connection. But first of all, I think there's a strong censorship in that area, you know. People who are unwilling to face it. For example, right now on our television, since I live in the United States now as well, I'm saying using the word ours, including myself in
Please.
It. On our television right now, you do not see very much about what is really happening in that place in Iraq, right? Because there's a strong editing quality that goes with it. People don't want what is happening in Iraq to make it into the rooms of homes of American families during dinner. But guess what? What people are afraid of showing their children, there are people who are actually living it, who are children, younger even, who are living there. So people are afraid to face that. But if you're afraid to face that, you don't want your child to see that, you know, like a representation of it, then why would you want it to happen to somebody else who's a child
Ishmael
just Bet, like your child? You know?
Catch your breath. We were going to take a short break and come back precisely to this. There's great art and a freedom from censorship in your book of War in West Africa, A Long Way Gone. We'll be right back on Open Source. I'm Christopher Lighton. This is Open Source. We're talking about the children's war in West Africa, one of scores, perhaps, of children's wars around the world. Human Rights Watch says 250,000, maybe 500,000 children have been enlisted in warfare. And in an appalling number of cases, there are countries that have been where the governments are enlisting the children. And in a number of cases, governments supported and armed by the United States. Ishmael Beya, thank you for telling this story. You lived for years in this country before anybody really knew who you were. When did you come to realize that you had to tell your story?
Well, you know, I think I realized the more I lived in this country, I realized that there was such a disconnection from what was going on in the rest of the world in terms of children being used in war, that having been lucky enough not only to get out of that war, but to having a family here in the United States to go to school and have an education, that I needed to do something about it, that I needed to speak about it, to use my personal experiences so that people can not only understand what happens, but the possibilities of getting out of it. So I had spoken at a lot of UN, Human Rights Watch, and you know, basically whoever was doing something about it. But each time I would speak on this panel, so I would talk somewhere for 20 minutes, half an hour, I realized that it wasn't enough for me to really explain what happens to children based on my experience of it. So when I went to college at Oberlin College, I took some writing classes, and I realized that I could write a book. And with the help of certain professors there who saw that I had a skill in writing and knew the importance of this story, kind of helped me along and you know, gave me the extra support
Ishmael,
I needed
who
to,
did
be
your,
able to write.
Who did your classmates think you were?
When I was in high school and even when I went to college, I would never introduce myself as a kid who lived through a war because I didn't think that was good because I wanted people to see me for who I was now and who I am now. And then when they learn about my life later, they can put it together because my life before the war, during the war, and after the war makes me who I am, not just one instance of it. So I didn't. So a lot of people thought, oh, Ishmael's the kid from New York or he's from Sierra Leone, some people who knew where that was. But as time went on, there were certain friends who found out that there were certain things I wasn't telling them. But they could never imagine to the extent of things that I wasn't telling them. During my classes, when I would write stories, you know, I remember the first time I wrote the first chapter about running from the war. I did not specify whether it was fiction or nonfiction. Mm-hmm. It was in a fiction writing class. And I remember everyone coming to class and thinking that, you know, this is not something that anyone can write if they didn't live with it. And my professor already knew about my background. So he said, you know, if you want to write this, you know, I will help you work on it, you know. Mm-hmm. So then that's how it started.
It's hard enough for a lot of veterans, Vietnam included, perhaps especially, to tell their stories. But to have survived a war in a country that Americans don't know and a war that very few people had even heard of must have been a very special burden.
It was a pretty tough burden to keep that in my head and to sort of not share it with anyone. But, you know, I realized that, you know, I could use it because what happened there, I would never be able to forget it. But I realized that I could use it, however difficult it is to remember it, to expose this so that others that are there now can be helped. Not in Sierra Leone currently, but in other places where this is happening can be helped, you know. And I felt like that was important to do. Mm-hmm. And now it's not easy speaking about it. Always going on speaking about it, even writing about it was extremely difficult. But what gave me the strength is remembering those who were there and the need for that to stop. And for those who have already been affected, for them to be helped.
Did it change your relationships with people, Americans, to tell this story, to show them your wound, so to speak? And did you have real relationships before the news was out?
Yes, I did have real relationships before the news was out. But then when the news came out, I mean, there are certain people who definitely were shocked at, because I've never told them, even though I was friends with them. And there are certain people who I was friends with them who always knew there was something I wasn't telling them, but they didn't know this was it. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of shock. I mean, obviously, there are some people who, when they hear this, it changes the perception of you. But I think for some people, it made them understand more of how I'd been reacting to a lot of things during my life with them. For example, how, you know, amongst my friends, there are very little things that bother me. And people always think, how come you're so calm all the time? What is your problem? You know, how come you don't get upset about this or that? So I think a lot of people, these things kind of made sense to them after they learned from where I'm coming from.
You remind me of Chris Hedges' book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. And there are so many scenes in A Long Way Gone that echo that same theme. The lieutenant who was rallying you and the other kids with all this nonsense about our job is a serious one and we have the most capable soldiers who will do anything to defend the country. We are not like the rebels, those riffraffs who kill people for no reason. We kill them for the good and betterment of this country. So respect all these men, he said, for offering their services. What was the design of this book, Ishmael, if I may ask, and the process of writing it, to say something new to this American moment that people would understand and take to heart?
I think one of the things that I wanted to do was to write a book that showed what war does to human beings, that what war does to human beings, regardless of who they are, where they are, is the same everywhere. And that's universal, that it takes away what makes you human in a way. It strips you from those compassion, those ethical and moral standards that you would, you know, come to understand if you grew up in a peaceful place. And how by doing so, it physically for some people and psychologically damages you, but also how that can be repaired and how that can bring about a deeper understanding of life itself. And I wanted people to understand this so that they don't have to live through what I lived through to appreciate their life or to be in a position to prevent this from happening to other people. So those are some of the things that I wanted to bring to people, to show that the basic madness of war, regardless of all the political hoopla, whatever it is that people try to justify, is that when you're there, it becomes your life or the next person's life. That for you to live through war requires somebody else to die. And that during war, because you dehumanize other human beings, you are absolutely in no position to understand in them, their culture, or anything. So through war itself, we cannot be in a position to understand anyone, because the whole point of war is to kill other people. That's the basic madness of it.
Ishmael, everybody knows that this book is being sold at Starbucks. We wondered if it should be sold at Tiffany's, too, you know, next to the diamond counter. But on our website, a writer called My Nocturama posted something last week. It was this. He said, I wonder if Ishmael has any sense of dissonance or discomfort having this as close to unimaginable story available at coffee shops around the country. He wonders what it feels like for you, Ishmael, your childhood contained in book form, to be sold among all the other homogenized comfort in one of America's most famous corporate chains. Should we worry about that, or should we just carry on and read it?
I think just carry on and read it. I mean, when you know, Starbucks came on board to represent the book, they asked me, asked the author of the book, how would you feel about that? And I said, I think it's wonderful, because the purpose of writing this book is to get as many people to read it. And that's the purpose of writing, I think, sharing this story. So I'm not partial to a Starbucks drinker. I'm not saying if you drink Starbucks, you can't read my book. I mean, this by them, I think, and they did a tremendous job in really making this available to a lot of people. Many, many people discovered the book by going to Starbucks to get a cup of coffee, and they saw it and they were like, what is this? And then they looked at it and then they bought it and read it and knew that Sierra Leone was a country. It existed somewhere, that there was a civil war there at some point, that somebody came out of it, that and learned all these things. So for me, I look at it more as a way of reaching the public, reaching the different spheres of public everywhere, rather than,
We won't quibble about that. You write in the book, Ishmael, these days I live in three worlds, my dreams and the experiences of my new life, which trigger memories from the past. I wonder, what do you dream these nights? And do you still have migraines? Do you still have nightmares?
I still do have those things, you know, healing from war. I believe that from my experience of it particularly does not mean forgetting, does not mean not having these nightmares anymore. It means that living with these memories, having these nightmares, but learning to live with them well and positively and transforming them so they become more of instructional tools to me rather than things that would handicap me. So I still have nightmares. I still have flashbacks that are triggered by different instances of my daily life. It could be a child holding their mother's or father's hand and crying. It could be a sharp sound coming from a tire exploding. It could be anything. Somebody could run fast and it'll trigger different things. But I've come to control them so much that when they happen, I either smile because I know that I'm not there, that there's just something that is still in the process of getting out of my system or I'm trying to learn to live with. So it doesn't disturb me anymore because I have that control of it.
Ishmael, a U.S. Marine who fought in Iraq and killed people, told us in this program a month or so ago, he said, don't worry about me, post-traumatic stress disorder. I have great shock absorbers. And it's one of those comments that makes you wonder. How do you test your own shock absorbers here? How do you test your own redemption and recovery? Or is it one of these things like a recovering drinker that you'll be recovering from all your life?
No, I don't think it's necessarily recovering from it all my life. It's just that I know I've come to learn the hard way what it is that violence really is. And so I don't want anything to do with it. So I think that's the courage that I have. That's the strength that I have. Say, for example, you know, I went to college. I went to high school. Sometimes some people think they are tough and they want to fight you. I don't want to fight anyone because for me, I know that it takes courage to actually walk away from such things. Mm. That the easiest thing to do is to raise a fist and hit somebody. But that anyone can do. But to walk away from it, that requires a certain amount of courage and certain understanding of things. So for me, those instances is what tests me. And this is not to say that I don't get angry or I don't, because I'm still human. So I exhibit those human emotions that everyone else exhibits. But I'm just very careful to make sure that I don't easily succumb to any of those things, because we all have those temptations. And I can't do it right now because I think I've lived through so much violence that I almost feel like it's been sucked out of me. All of it, the tendencies of it are not as present as it might be, or even the romanticization of it. None of those things are there anymore because I've lived through so much violence and that I think it's even too much for a person my age to have lived through.
Absolutely. Ishmael, I think a lot of readers are fascinated that you were introduced so young and so enthusiastically to Shakespeare, and that it made a mark on you, and that you could recite it years later. I wonder, a couple of things. I mean, what did you learn in life that you could teach Shakespeare? Or what do you remember of him now that makes more sense after all this? And do you want to recite a little for us from Macbeth or Hamlet or anything else?
Actually, I recite something that, I think one of the reasons why I love Shakespeare, not only because it was something that we read since day one, since you started learning how to read in school because of the British influence we had there. But it's also because I really loved it because I felt like his writing was just absolutely amazing and it's timeless, you know. And one of the things that the quote that I think really still... It's very important, and it's so kind of reflective on this day and age that we have. It's a quote from King Lear, when the king is in the rain with the fool, and he realized what had happened with him, what he had done. And then he says to the fool, when we are born, we cry that we've come to this great stage of fools. I think that makes so much sense to me to this day because, you know, it seems to me that, you know, throughout history, we just are not learning from our experiences and the same things keep happening over and over and no one seems to be willing especially people who are in a position of power to do things about it, to prevent things from happening.
Ishmael Bea, I wonder, are there still dues to be paid in Sierra Leone? I presume your book is sold there, but would you go back, do you suppose? Could you be a redemptive voice in your own country?
I actually was back in Sierra Leone last year for the first time since I left. And one of the things that I'm doing alongside the book is also creating a foundation because of what I saw there. Just a tremendous number of young people just hanging about, not knowing what to do with their lives. So I'm starting a foundation to be able to provide educational and vocational opportunities for them so that they can take charge of their lives again. So I would definitely go back to Sierra Leone. I would do what I can to help. And I'm not doing this because from a sense of guilt or anything, but it's because I care deeply about that place as my home, regardless of what happened there. When I went there, I was able to sleep deeper there than I've been able to sleep anywhere. And, you know, it's a place that I think will regain its wholeness again. And that requires some of us who have traveled abroad to be able to give back and go back and do certain things by bypassing government and just taking it directly to people who can really help.
Ishmael, last question. What does it tell us about our country, the United States, that this book has struck a nerve?
Well, you know, I think what it really tells is that people in this country, first of all, Americans are very generous, but also that Americans want to know about other places. But oftentimes the mediums that they have that expose them to the world do not do that job for them. For me, that's what I came to realize by writing this book, that people do want to know about certain things, but they just don't have the medium to do it. And what is given to them, it's not enough. That when you connect them, when you show them what other places are, that there's a genuine care and concern that comes out of that. And I think this goes to show by the reception of the book that's been happening, that people do want to learn something else.
Ishmael Bea, it's a very striking book, written with great restraint and great skill. Write another one, and let's keep talking. Ishmael Bea, thank you very, very much for A Long Way Gone and for joining us on Open Source. You can keep talking about children's wars, grown-ups' wars. You can pitch us a show on your own at radioopensource.org. You can also download any show there and subscribe to Open Source as a podcast. Open Source is produced in association with WGBH Radio in Boston. The program is made possible by the Schooner Foundation, whose contributors support the Landmine Survivors Network, offering health, opportunities, and rights to mine victims worldwide. LandmineSurvivors.org. RadioOpenSource.org, the website, is hosted by Contegix, Contegix.com. Our show is produced by David Miller, Catherine Bidwell, Chelsea Mers, Robin Amer, and Greta Pemberton, with help from Sam Gail Rosen. Robin Moore was our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
PRI, Public Radio International.